There it is. All right.
We're live.
Welcome to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam, the July 27th edition. How are you guys doing?
Great.
June. Let's not skip ahead to July, homies.
You're right. June 27th. I was getting excited because July is when I get to first see the first Presidio Bitcoin, the Builders Summit. Is that what it's called? Builders Summit? Builders Program?
Builder.
Builder.
Just Builder. Okay.
Simple.
But it happened last night. I was out of town. So one of the big topics I want to hear about is like how to go. What happened?
Me too. I was also out of town. This is big news.
I just ran with it.
Yeah.
It's just Lance Armstrong is over here in his Mellow Johnny.
Yeah.
Cycling jersey.
We have a new sponsor for the show. Mellow Johnny's.
Do you want, before we get into Builders, do you want to tell us why you're wearing a jersey? Did you actually ride in from home today?
Yeah, I biked to work today.
Nice.
Decided to keep the kit on.
Good. I like it. Go authentic, organic. We're not trying to pose as a news show here. We're just being ourselves, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to also say, Steve, I don't know what you're doing, but your arm's looking swollen. So I don't know if it's not just the biking, but it's a good look. Good look.
Well, we now have a pull-up bar at Presidio Bitcoin. So
That explains it.
Yeah. We are...
Steve got me into hanging, which I've just set a new personal best. I'm not much of a hanger, but do you know what hanging is?
Well, you just hang on the bar?
Yeah, that's like a thing. I didn't know that was a thing, but Steve got me into it.
Is it for like lengthening the spine? Is that kind of the main thing?
I think it's like shoulders and opening up and I don't know all of
grip strength, rock climbing.
Okay.
Is that the main thing is rock climbing? I heard it's like a longevity marker. I heard there's all kinds of...
Yeah,
different benefits multiple
benefits.
So we need the sauna at Presidio Bitcoin now.
And the cold plunge. We need the contrast therapy. Come on, it's not a real all podcast if you don't have contrast therapy discussed.
Yeah, exactly.
In every episode.
How long can you hang for?
Yeah, how long do you get?
So I'm new at it. This is my first try. I actually did it with a 50-pound assist, and I did 2 minutes, and it was extremely painful.
What's a 50-pound assist?
Meaning like I'm not holding my whole body weight. I have like a 50-pound assist. So I'm, you know, my body weight minus 50 pounds.
Come on.
Yeah.
Oh, damn. Steve's coming at you.
I mean, for pull-ups, the assist is reasonable, but just hang in. Come on.
Well, I wanted to hit 2 minutes. So I hit 2 minutes.
Okay.
That was very challenging.
It's a good first 50-pound
assist, it was very, very challenging.
I thought you were going to say you had a 50-pound weight on your back.
No. That's once you get more advanced.
Steve, what's yours?
I can do 2 minutes unassisted.
That's good.
Yeah, that's
but
solid.
It wasn't your first time, was it?
Ooh.
Don't shame me for getting into the game, okay?
My first time, I lasted like 11 seconds. Because you... instantly feel the pain.
Yeah, I think that's what she said moment, but
no, we're still on my hand.
Okay.
And because I saw some Instagram reel where this guy is on like at Venice Beach challenging people to last 1 minute, and I'm like, that seems not too hard.
Yeah.
So then I got up on my pull up bar and I held on, and like 11 seconds later, I let go, and I'm like, there's no way I can last a minute. And then my kid did it and he lasted well over a minute, and I'm like, okay, well, I gotta man up. And then I did it again, suffered through the initial pain, and then got to a minute. But yeah, I can do 2 minutes now.
Yeah. What about pull-ups? We should have some kind of like Presidio Bitcoin pull-up competition. Where are you guys at in the pull-up game?
I can do 13 pull-ups right now.
All right, that's solid.
Or three sets of 10.
Nice.
Right. Steve's a beast.
Yeah.
That's why he's got those guns.
That's right.
I don't think I'd win, though. I think we have other people at Presidio Bitcoin that would top me.
Is it the ringleader of the sprints? Can we say his name on air? I don't know.
He's pretty
the ringleader of the sprints.
Max somehow, the other Max, didn't know we had a pull-up bar until yesterday. And then I saw him. He looks formidable as well.
Yeah.
So.
It's not necessarily the most jacked guys. Like,
and I definitely, yeah, I wouldn't discount Leo. And Alex used to do it for hockey, I know, right?
Mm.
Our producer and lead of Presidio Bitcoin, Alex. So it'd be a good competition. I don't know who would win.
Yeah. I will say I learned a little bit of a a hack here for me. I could throw my own hat in the ring too. We'll have to do when we get back in person. But Leishman, of all people, told me that I could do more if I breathed properly. My problem was that I was not breathing properly. So now I'm more focused on the breath.
Oh, interesting.
And I could add a couple extra reps in. So
I also think you want to keep your chin up when you're doing it too.
Yeah.
That's another tip that was
very focused on breathing to get through the 2 minutes hang. Like the whole thing was like a meditation for me just because it was so hard. Like the last 15 seconds, it was so hard.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, our action item is we're going to have a Presidio Bitcoin pull-up competition.
I love it.
Yes.
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. You asked about Builder though.
Builders. Yeah. Tell me about the topic.
So what was it? 3 weeks ago, I think, on this show, we thought of this idea on the show. And in retrospect, it seems so obvious to have a monthly meetup that's focused on building applications with a Bitcoin twist. But a similar structure and format to BitDevs, but a very different intended audience and vibe, far less technical, and welcoming and inviting for designers, PMs, in our case, Silicon Valley folks who don't necessarily identify as Bitcoiners. So we move fast. So we scrambled, put together some structure and a topic list and marketed it and had our first one last night at Presidio Bitcoin. We moved so fast that the two of you couldn't even attend because you're out. But I'm glad we did it. We had 30 people show up. So we had a great attendance for the first one. And
the composition of people was engineers, builders, kind of existing Bitcoin.
It was a good, I'd call it a great number of people. It's a good start for the composition, but we want to keep improving. We had a couple designers, a handful of product managers, mostly engineers though. And aside from maybe a couple people, most were Bitcoiners, pretty diehard Bitcoiners, which of course is totally fine and welcome. But we're also trying to reach out to people who wouldn't identify necessarily as a Bitcoiner. So definitely room for improvement there. But as a first event, I think it's totally fine. Plus, I think a bunch of us have reached out to a lot of our Bitcoin curious but non-Bitcoiner tech friends, and a lot of them couldn't make this date or are traveling for the summer. So I think it'll just get better each month from a composition standpoint. Then we put together a topic list, much like BitDevs does, with some twists though. We want to make demos of a staple of the meetup. And we had two demos. We had a startup showcase where one of the startups that works out of Presidio Bitcoin, Agicash, which they haven't even launched yet. So there's some alpha.
That's a little alpha right there, yeah.
Alpha last night and on the show here. But this is Bob Scully's startup and Damien as well. And so Damien demoed Agicash for the audience. I think we kept that short, like a couple minute demo, and then open it up to audience questions. I think it'd be better to give more time for audience engagement. And sure enough, there's like 8 different people with questions or comments about the demo. So really good engagement.
Were the questions kind of in the flavor of like maybe you might think about the product, the business, that kind of stuff versus kind of deep?
It was a good mix. A little more technical than I think we want in this, but there were go-to-market and product and business questions as well.
One broader question, given that they're focused on sort of eCash, I'm curious, like how much of the audience was already familiar with eCash and how it worked, or for how many of them was this totally brand new and they were just like, whoa, this is an exciting possibility?
We didn't explicitly ask that, but because the audience was primarily Bitcoiners, half of which have been to a BitDevs before. I mean, I think the audience generally was leaned towards technical and knowing what eCash, things like that were.
Cool.
And thus there were more technical questions than I'd expect in future meetups for this particular meetup. But still, great audience engagement. And then the other demo was an impromptu. One of the audience members was super excited and proud of his vibe-coded app. So he got up and plugged his computer in and demoed the vibe-coded app, which is really cool. And then so, you know, it's nice to have like...
The app was?
Yeah, what was it?
Like, yeah, well, it was there. Interestingly, it was Stratum, Bitcoin mining protocol Stratum. There's a website that someone else created that shows a visualization of this, you know, of Stratum mining protocol. And the guy who did a demo last night, he wanted to see different types of visualizations. Hmm. And while he's a Swift programmer, but he doesn't know how to program in JavaScript or what, you know, whatever this website, however it was developed. So he made the modification just through vibe coding, English prompting, and created the visualizations he was hoping for. So it's cool. And then he explained this. They're good questions from the audience on that too. So I think that was good. Then we moved to like a products section where we talked about the Square accepting Bitcoin announcement and the returns on Block's Lightning node, Coinbase's credit card. Phenomenal engagement across those topics. So much so that we went over. I mean, we had probably like 20 different things queued up for the product section. We anticipated we'd get through about half, and we got through maybe a third. And we still went way over the allotted time we had in mind.
So the format, as it, my understanding is, the kind of the BitDevs and Socratic seminar. Were you introducing one of those products, like you would explain how the Coinbase acceptance works, or was that something that somebody would pop up from the audience and kind of they would give the overview of it?
Yeah, so Haley joined as moderator, so the two of us moderated, and the format, the moderators introduced the topic, guide the discussion, but shouldn't dominate the discussion. So each of these topics, if the moderator is doing their job, they solicit audience engagement. And we had great engagement, like so much so that we ran over way over allotted times. It's obviously we hit it out of the park in terms of our goal of audience engagement, where the engagement was questions, ideas, opinions, everything we'd want to see from from a lot of people in the audience. It wasn't just like one or two people. So that was really, really good to see.
Did you see any folks that did not realize, for example, that maybe there's a business model in the LSP or in routing fees that are now interested in that? Or was there any interesting takes that you hadn't heard before?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I can't, because it's Chatham House rules, I can't name people, but you know, someone that the three of us know that runs a business with like Lightning routing nodes. You know, he had some really, you know, good comments. There was just overall very good audience engagement and comments. Then we moved on. We covered a couple of regulatory things fairly quickly. Then we moved on to what I was most excited to cover, which was design. And then we had some discussion topics queued up. And for design, we had a couple topics in the queue. The first was sats and the Bitcoin B symbol, which of course, spicy topic and fun to talk about. And then the other was seedless is safer, which is also spicy. So we covered the first one, and that was a really rich, full discussion. Surprisingly, all but one or two people in the audience are, you know, pro Bitcoin B symbol and getting rid of the sats, visually at least. And there are a couple of people that you know are sats the standard, sats maxis. But that was a good discussion. It's kind of what I hope to see in future builder meetups. Because we ran over time so much, we just skipped the seedless is safer, so we can tackle that in a future event. Then we moved on to discussion topics, and we had three queued up. We only were able to touch on one of the three. And the first one is just vibe coding. And this is just sort of a more of a like get an understanding of the audience, who's vibe coded, what tools do they use, what do they build, And that was a great discussion, just to, especially for a first meetup and getting to know folks. And there was definitely a lot of interest in vibe coding. And there's just no question in my mind that's going to be a future part of every meetup. Talking about the tools, talking about our experiences with them, talking about and demonstrating and showing what people build. No question that's going to be a big part of this.
What did you learn from that? Were most people using Replit or other stuff? And did people actually go through and show their prompts? Were there any like surprises in how people were prompting to get better results?
The tools were a wide variety, just like we've talked about ourselves and other people we've chatted with. And then there's just the one demo. And but we already have teed up for next month. We're going to have a demonstration of someone going from zero to a fully working Bitcoin tipping app in under 15 minutes, and we'll show all the prompts so people can see that progression and how that can be done.
Meaning that's awesome. Going to be done live, or that's already done and going to be demoed, the 15-minute process can be demoed in a shorter period?
It's going to be done live.
That's awesome.
Oh, cool.
And one thing we didn't do yesterday was record or live stream the demos, and we do intend to. So next time we'll be prepared to do that and do the demos up front. Yeah. So overall, it went really well. Like, given the rush, you know, to get, you know, we like to move fast and then iterate. And yeah, we did really well on that to get the first one going, learned from it. The main learning, and then at the end, we asked for audience feedback about what they liked, what they didn't like. Everyone, I mean, we stayed till like 9:15 p.m., and I think we could have stayed till midnight. There was that much interest.
That's
awesome.
People, like, no one left, and everyone was super paying attention and engaged all the way to the end. But the main area of improvement, and I completely agree with what people in the audience said, is that we spent too much time on, like, sort of news product or news topics. And people obviously liked that because they just kept talking about it, but it really required the moderators to like push to get to the next stuff. But then once people's got a taste for like what I thought were the meaty parts, then everyone's like, we want more of that. So yeah. Design discussion.
Yeah.
And just these general, we talked about vibe coding, but the other ones we had teed up was the payments for applications using traditional payment mechanisms, stable coins or Bitcoin. That'll be a recurring theme, I think, at this meetup. So like, let's get this discussion started though, right? And then this whole billboard idea I brought up last week, which I don't even really have a concrete idea. It's just this notion of an idea. We were going to discuss that
idea
as well. Yes. Yes. A concept of a concept.
An announcement of a concept.
So we're going to shift those segments earlier in the program. So we're going to do like quick intro, demos, record and live stream that, then turn the cameras off, and then do design and other discussions.
Yeah.
And then do newsy stuff at the end. And we might not even get to the newsy stuff because the discussions are so rich and everyone seemed completely fine with that. Even though people enjoy talking about the news and commenting on it, everyone seemed totally fine if that just gets pushed off at the end or even not discussed at all. Because actually, at BitDevs, there's a pretty healthy... There was some overlap with us talking about the news with BitDevs. So.
Yeah. I hear there's like also a weekly podcast on that too. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, the news seems like something you can kind of get other places. Whereas, like, what are builders actually using? What are the tools? What are the demos? Being able to ask them... Where else do you get that? There's not really a good place to get that. So it's not surprising to me that that would be like a bigger draw and that would sort of encourage, like, people would want that to be more of what the purpose of the thing is.
And the live prompting and workshops, I mean, that's like, valuable. That's what I want for the next one.
So I'm super optimistic about it just getting better every month. I think it's going to be tremendously successful. My main concern now is just like... I think there's going to be demand for like 6 hours of content. And, you know, realistically, we got to shove it into 2 hours. So I think we might have to, like, you know, cut, you only have one startup showcase per event and one vibe coding demo per event just from time constraints. We can also work to get more efficient too, with getting people set up the demo and making sure that when we switch from one person to another, it's fast and there's not like a 2 minute pause or whatever. So
it's a great problem to have.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah. So is one thing.
Oh, go ahead.
Go for it, DK.
Yeah. Is there any thought, like, would it ever make sense to break down some of the things and do more frequent even than once a month? Or does that just get logistically complex and tough for people to schedule?
I think that'd be too much.
I think it's better to have the shelling point. And it's also nice because we have like an event almost every Thursday now. So it's kind of like that's, people remember that. So one topic that, I mean, I was hoping we would discuss today, and maybe this is kind of a good transition, is the Bitcoin versus stable coins. What were some of your takeaways from that conversation? Because I've been thinking a lot about this. Too. Like, what's your TLDR?
Nada, because we didn't get to it.
Oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Damn.
No, we'll start with that. I mean, our topic list is public, so anyone can go look at it. We only covered a third of the stuff. So it wasn't because we were inefficient, like very rich discussion and great engagement throughout. So kind of like you said, Max, I mean, great problem to have, but we only covered a third of our stuff. So
I think we could still talk about it. Cause I'm curious. It's a topic that I think we've maybe listed, or I know we've sort of touched on in our group chat, but I don't think we've really gotten anywhere with it yet. And so maybe I can sort of, I'll play the sort of, you know, the left side of the bell curve, you know, it's like, why don't we just use stable coins for all our apps? I don't know. Like, is censorship?
I'm going to play that side too.
You're the Jedi, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I have some thoughts on Bitcoin a little bit, but maybe even to give a bit more context on this. So, one question, or at least the way I've thought about this is particularly in the realm of new business models using micropayments, because right now, obviously, no one does micropayments on the web. And I think there's a very interesting and rich sort of debate about why that is. It could be one reason. It could be a few reasons. I've seen very, I think, compelling arguments for a few of them, which I think is worth outlining. And then the other question is just in general, as we go more agentic and agents are doing more things on the web, you know, clearly there's going to be new business models around agents doing payments. Are they going to use Bitcoin? Are they going to use stable coins? So maybe just to start, because this is something I really feel like I don't know the answer to. I have my own gut. But as I thought more about why don't we have micropayments on the web? And there was a really interesting article I shared with you, a Stratechery article talking about sort of Microsoft and then talking about the agentic web. And, you know, he mentioned, I think, what's his name? Not Kevin Smith. That's a funny director, but, whoever the, CTO is at Microsoft, that the original
Scott,
said,
me.
Yeah. Exactly. Not Kevin Smith. That would be something else I recommend people check out. But he basically was making the argument that part of the original sin of the web is not having payments. And if we're going to, or at least, actually, that was the Stratechery guy that was making that argument. And this guy is talking about, what if we have a new open agentic web? Didn't talk about payments specifically. But because we didn't have payments in the original version of the web, then all of a sudden, attention ended up becoming the currency of the web and has trapped us in one of two hells, either advertising hell, where the currency that we all pay with is human attention, which is, of course, scarce, and we end up in subscription hell, where you end up paying for a subscription to everything, and then you're like, shit, like, I want to watch this one show on Disney, but it's not on Netflix. I'm not going to pay another $25 a month. And so you end up in this situation where, like, no one is happy with the status quo. Now, one interesting point that the Stratechery guy made is we actually do have micropayments today, but you don't see it. And the micropayments are happening, for example, in like Google's ad network, where behind the scenes, you know, there's a lot of like real-time, transactions being done between, okay, here's a human on this web page, find which ad to serve them, you know, I guess do the accounting to be able to pay the micro fractions of a cent for that ad. And in aggregate, that ends up being, you know, whatever it is, multi-trillion dollar economy. So that's kind of one argument. I've seen Gigi put out a really nice essay some years ago where he argues that the reason attention became the currency of the web is because any sort of debt or credit-based system, it's much more challenging to sort of settle up in real time. And so as an example, you know, if I need to make a number of payments as like an example with imagine an agent in this sort of inference world. And then all of a sudden I make whatever 10,000 payments and they're whatever a fraction of a cent, but in aggregate it starts to add up. And then I try and do a charge back on that. That's actually going to be, you know, impossible if you want to have a completely open system where, you know, you're using a credit-based money. So anyways, he has some interesting arguments around that about why attention became the currency of the web there. I'm not sure I buy that that couldn't be done with stable coins or dollars if there was, you know, the proper accounting of that. And I think that's kind of what the Sir Tetri article is making, the argument that we do have micropayments just with ads in the background. The most compelling argument that I've read so far for why we don't have micropayments came from Szabo, which, you know, obviously Szabo is always ahead of the curve. And his argument is basically just that the mental transaction costs are too high.
Yep.
And so if I'm a human and I'm on the web, like every time I want to click an article, like even if clicking, yes, show me this article is only 0.001 cents, it's too expensive for my attention to be able to calculate, well, do I want to pay 0.001 cents? It's just easier to pay for things in bundles. That to me is the most compelling sort of reason we don't have micropayments. And if that's the case, then an agentic web is going to solve that problem entirely because agents don't have the attention problem. So in that world, I think micropayments are going to thrive. Then there's the question of if it's not really a problem with the credit-based system, then stablecoins should do just fine for them. So that's kind of my setup. What do you guys think?
Well, I'm kind of the mind that the micropayments are too much for an individual's, you know, you don't want to have to think about every action. So you want to kind of buy in bundles or have sort of, you know, draw down as you use it. And I think we've had lots of examples of this. It used to be that way. You'd buy a bundle of text messages from your mobile phone operator, the carrier, and then as you would send a text, it would draw down on your account and it would be a micropayment similar to like the Google Ads example you mentioned, but you're buying a bundle of it. It's just being sort of deducted bit by bit. I find that today when I'm vibe coding, I have like Claude code and I have a API key tied to a credit card. And every time I prompt, I can refresh the usage stats and I can see, oh, that prompt cost me 37 cents or less even. But that concept of like, I need to decide each time is, I think, too hard, like swipe a credit card or make a decision. I think the idea of like having some sort of relationship and bundle and drawdown is kind of a natural way for humans to work. But I do think that, like you mentioned, in an agentic world where the agent is the one receiving the money and making the decision about where to spend the money, there's none of that mental overhead or kind of the connectivity needed. So I do think there's like a chance that we get there with agents, but I think that like the idea of stable coins for payments versus Bitcoin native payments is possibly related, but different than micropayments. Micropayments may or may not be a thing, but I think there's this whole idea of, you know, are stable coins what people want? Are they good enough? What are the risks? What are the trade-offs? Is Bitcoin a better payment system today? Will it be a better payment system over time? So I think for that we should have Steve weigh in because he's the guy who works on this every day.
Well, I already said I'm not going to take the Bitcoin stance. I'll take the TradFi or stablecoin stance. But I wanted to actually respond to one thing you said, David. I don't agree with you. The argument you gave about that humans don't want to deal with micropayments, that's a very common response, and I think it's a weak response because micropayments don't require that the user gives attention to every sub-penny payment. So I think that's just a flawed UI. It's not a flaw in micropayments. Like, I could pay like a sub-penny amount of money per web page or per unit of content, but I don't have to like actively make a decision each micropayment. It's just happening in the background. Mm-hmm. And I also didn't have to sign up for an annual premium subscription to do that. I literally am just paying piece by piece. So
yeah, but I think we're saying the same thing.
We're not. You said that micropayments would be used by AI maybe, but not humans, because humans don't want to have to make a decision every micropayment. And I'm saying that's a flawed UI, not a flaw in micropayments.
Huh. Right. So, but the example that I gave is a micropayments example. I'll give an even more extreme example, which is sort of demonstrates the same structure is I made an app, I think I may have shared this with you. I made an app this week where I connect all your HealthKit data to an LLM so you can chat and get insights about your HealthKit data. And so I want to have a path toward privacy. So I chose DeepSeek. And so I topped up $10 with DeepSeek because you could eventually run on your own infrastructure on this.
Is that a joke?
No. Why is that?
It's a toasted by an American company, I think is where he's hoping this goes. But right now it's pretty terrifying.
No, my point is it's terrifying, but it's also just me playing around. There's a path toward me saying, take DeepSeek, an open source model, run it on my own infrastructure, and nobody but me, the one mm-hmm. who runs the app, has access to the data.
You should check out Maple for that, by the way. Maple AI, they already are running DeepSeek.
Yeah. Then you don't have to host your own Nitro servers or whatever.
Yeah. Perfect. So that's probably like the right solution. I mean, it's more just like a play thing. It's not meant to be like a real thing. But the point is I topped up $10 with DeepSeek, and now I have a bunch of people using the app, you know, using my DeepSeek payment. And I think I've spent 2 cents total so far across everybody who's using it. And there's, you know, maybe half a dozen people using it. All their queries has used 2 cents. So,
but again, I still think, I mean, I've heard this argument. I've heard this negative response to micropayments over and over again from tech people saying that like, oh, humans don't want to make a decision for every micropayment, which is the argument you made earlier. And I totally disagree with it. I agree that humans don't want to make a decision every micropayment, but I would call that a flawed UI, not a flaw in micropayments. Simply don't have the user make a decision every micropayment.
Yeah.
And I mean, as far as this subscription model, I clearly it's popular, but is it the natural form that humans want? I'd say no. Like, there's a lot of friction in having to decide, like, oh, do I really want to do annual subscription or even a monthly subscription?
I'm not talking about a subscription.
It's like, no.
I'm saying
you said topping up. You said
top up $10. It's not a subscription.
Yeah,
$10 input.
Right. So that's friction. There's a lot of people who drop off because they don't want to pay that much money up front. So like if I came across a new like media content or brand that I was completely unfamiliar with, I'm not comfortable $10, $100, whatever it is up front. Like, no, I don't even know who this person is or the content. But if I can pay a micropayment to just get a dose of it and then be like, oh, I do like it, and then pay a little bit more.
But what's the UX?
Well, I actually have a UX in mind. So I think the way that...
Micropayments.
Well,
like, but there's some aggregation point. Like you have a connected wallet that you approve and sign when you want the payment to be made. So is there like a paywall where you click yes or how does it work?
Well, we already have this with Albi. So I actually do this with Bitcoin and Albi, right? So with Albi, the way it works is I have a browser extension. I can just top up my wallet there. And because it's, you know, connected with Via Nostra Wallet Connect to all my other apps, I can literally earn sats or Bitcoin on Primal, go into the Albi wallet. What's really nice is you can then set a budget via Nostra Wallet Connect for any site that you use. And so you have two options. You can either like for a site like Stacker News, I just have a monthly budget. I literally just click a button to do my zap. I don't even know, you know, that I don't have to think anything. I literally just click a button. It works. And then if it's a new site that also hooks in via Nostra Wallet Connect, then you actually can get the experience you're talking about, Steve, where it's like, I don't trust this site and I don't want to pay whatever amount of money, but they'll offer me for 2 cents the ability to read this one article. And as long as it speaks NWC or WebLN, I literally just click the invoice button and it works. So I think to me, the best payments experience online by far right now is via Albi. And I think the argument for why it works in Bitcoin and Lightning, and why I'm still bullish Bitcoin and Lightning in the long run, and I'll take the other side of this, is because it's an open system. And so I do think stablecoins can clone a lot of this, and maybe they'll be able to clone this, you know, whatever, next couple of year experience even better, where I have some kind of a browser extension or wallet and use that for tipping. But in general, one of the big lessons I have with Bitcoin and eCash and all this stuff is if a system is permissioned, then the limits of what you can do in that system are always less. And if a system is not permissioned, which Bitcoin, Lightning, and eCash, I would say is like the unpermissioned version of this, you're just going to have way more experimentation and you can like basically try things that, you know, even if they find the stablecoin sort of a local maximum over the next 2 to 3 years, which is probably right, maybe there's some weird way of doing payments that no one's thought of yet that can only work in the Bitcoin Lightning sort of cashew world. And in the long game, I'm more bullish on the open system. But in the short run, I would say, yeah, stablecoins can just clone the Alvi experience and people will probably be happier with that.
To give another example of the micropayment stuff, like a common occurrence that I run into today, and I'm sure many other people do too, is whether you're on Google or someone sends you a link over messaging, and it's a link to like the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, or Washington Post, or this or that media site, and you click on it, and it's a paywall.
It's horrible.
And like, I don't want to subscribe to like 75 different media publications because I'm not that's too much money in aggregate. I don't get enough value from any one of them or I at least don't know if I'm going to get enough value out of them. And so I'd be happy to pay like my fair share for the content that I click on to look at, right? Like a micropayment. And so the UX does not have to be me choosing every single time, do I want to pay 0.3 cents or 7.6 cents or whatever? No. Just like Max said, and we already have tools for this, like I set an overall budget and it could be for the entire web, right? And I'm willing to pay so much per day or month or whatever. I set that once and forget it. And I'm very comfortable economically with that. And then I just browse the web. And then anyone sending me a link, I can click on it and actually read it, get rid of the paywall. The UX is tremendously better. And I don't have this cognitive overhead. So to me, this is like a no-brainer. I don't know why this doesn't already exist.
So let's pause there. Why doesn't it exist, right? Like, I think we all agree that seems like a higher maximum than the local maximum of ads and subscription hell that we're in. Why didn't this evolve, right? So Gigi says it can't evolve with a credit-based system. I'm not sure I buy that. I'm saying maybe it's just sort of the accident of not having an open system and we just kind of got stuck in the wrong inertia. That seems the most likely to me. Well, why do you guys think we don't have this Alvi-like system where you just top up and explore the web right now?
Well, how would, maybe it's, we'd have to think through like Stripe and credit cards and stuff today. Like how would the experience we just described work with that?
Well,
you'd give your credit card to the browser. So like, yeah, why doesn't like Chrome and Safari support this?
Well, so there's a couple of things. One, if we had had, and Andreessen's talked about this before, like in Mosaic, if they had found a way to integrate a wallet into Mosaic from day zero, we probably would have this. My understanding is from what he was saying is at that time, you're basically only games in town were to play with the credit card networks like Visa and MasterCard. And again, permission versus permissionless, they're basically like, nah. And part of the reason that they're not going to do it is their existing old world business model is, I forget exactly what it is, but let's say they take 2% plus a fixed fee on every transaction. So that fixed fee, whether it's a quarter or a nickel or a dime, whatever it is more than the micropayment. But that doesn't explain why they couldn't just do the top up. If let me put $100 in this and then knock yourself out.
I think
out.
In the time of Mosaic, the concern, like people weren't comfortable giving their credit cards over the internet.
Yeah, that was pretty early. Yeah. People didn't even trust Amazon at that time.
And there was no like TLS. There was no HTTPS at the time. And I mean, so at the time of Mosaic, I think that's at least one of the reasons. But yeah, I mean, like ever since then, though, the past 15 or 20 years, why the fees of Visa, I don't see how that prevented Google and Safari from creating a situation where, you know, they build it into the browser, the consumers sign up for like a monthly budget, and then anything they browse on the web could be micropayments.
Well, I think there's a few things. One is the publishers grew up along with that other version of the web. So the publishers grew up, you know, throwing AdSense on there and monetizing via that style of micropayments, which is, you know, using attention and not having direct pay from the users. So it's really hard to get a publisher who's built in a certain way and has a bunch of, maybe there's journalists or writers on staff who have to get paid and they have monthly bills and they want recurrence. It's hard to shift them into a totally new world and say, hey, you're going to get paid for the value you create. And the days you don't create value, you don't get paid. That just like screws up everybody's, you know, rent or mortgage or whatever. So I think you could establish a new type of publisher who would opt into this idea if the other rest stuff didn't exist. Like maybe that still happens in the future. But I think like the existing publishers grew up in the old way. The other thing that I think is like maybe we're not seeing eye to eye on yet is I don't feel comfortable topping up $100 into Chrome and then letting any site draw that down, because I trust Chrome, but I don't trust any site. So then am I going to whitelist a bunch of sites that I do trust to draw down? And then if Mac sends me a link to some scam site and they choose to draw down my whole $100,
how'd you know?
Like, am I just out of luck, or like how would that work? Do you whitelist proactively things, or do you trust that Chrome knows which sites are charging me too much or kind of behaving badly? How would that work?
I think that's easy. You can either whitelist manually, or you can say, hey, Chrome, like, you know, based on all of your knowledge, you have a rating system. If it's a green site, rock and roll. If it's not, if it's like a red or yellow site, then in that case, I do want to be shown a dialog box and make the conscious decision. Do I want to pay or not?
Yeah. So you need to bootstrap all of that too. That's a whole ecosystem.
But in addition, so I agree with one obvious option is to manually whitelist. So a UX cost on the user, but that just solves the problem. Two would be some kind of like trust, system, like Max just said. And so yes, DK, you'd have to bootstrap that, but that then basically achieves the same goal and reduces the UX burden on the user. A third thing that could work in conjunction with those is that you can set, Chrome would default to this, and the user could even override it, like some kind of like safety, or Max. Like you can't go to one website and it just draws down the entire $100 in one go. Like the most a page could cost is like a penny or something, and then if it exceeds that, I mean the publisher can request more, but if it exceeds some threshold, then the user is asked about it.
And that's the way Albie works today. Like, that's like the actual experience. You just say, I set a budget for these sites, and if it's a new site, just show me the dialog box.
Which is so exactly, I think we're all saying the same thing. We're saying some aggregated trust point, and then you draw down on that aggregated trust point. You configure the aggregated trust point.
Yeah, but the everything that we use today to top up is not broad. It's very specific.
This is part of my hope for what, when I first saw Stacker News, this was part of my hope for what I thought Stacker News could provide, is they are an aggregated trust point. You have a wallet connected there. You have value already stored in there, and you can upvote and actually recognize something, but it doesn't go to the publisher.
I disagree with that. I mean, so yes, we're asking the question 20 years ago, why didn't the aggregation, the centralized browser do this?
Right.
But today it's your own self-custody wallet. So your centralization point is your own self. It's like literally the billfold in your pocket. That's where you're setting the budget.
But you still need, you need some budget set somewhere. You need to decide what is allowed to draw
on your own, wallet.
So that's
not the same as like, topping up on Anthropic and topping up on Starbucks card and topping up, name the top 50 brands you use. Having top ups for all 50 is a very different experience, because you've got 50 different centralized brands you're topping up versus your own wallet in your pocket.
Yeah. I think there's two very interesting questions here. There's the question of the past, which I actually do think is very important to understand, because I think those incentives sort of dictate or at least inform what's going to happen in the future. So in the past, if you think about this, who would have had the ability to be these aggregation points? Well, it's the major browser. So it's basically Google or Apple. Google is probably not going to do this, because their business model is just the greatest business model in the history of mankind from ads. So why would they put a lot of money into this? It potentially cannibalizes their main business. Apple, then it makes sense for them to be the aggregation point with Safari and, potentially something in iOS. Then the question is, why didn't Apple go down the slide? I mean, one answer would be they're making so much from Google in the search payments that there's whatever, they're paying us $20 billion a year, we just don't care. Or maybe it's something else. Maybe just, somehow because inertia was so strong in this initial model, no one put in the time to go out there. Because to your point, you have to go out and build the network effects around all the different kinds of publishers, which is why, by the way, I'm so bullish right now on Nostra Wallet Connect, Albie, Bitcoin Lightning, open systems, because that's emerging bottoms up, right? We have, to your point, Steve, all the payments I do with Bitcoin or Lightning are in my self-custodial Albie wallet, which hooks up to my browser extension. And I literally I have one place that I use money on the web and it's awesome. So one could argue that it was just probably too much work for someone like Apple, and they're already being paid $20 billion a year. So it's just like, meh, that's my best guess.
Well, I think you have to bootstrap new ecosystems on all sides. You need publishers opting into this. You need users opting into this. You need value stored in presumably non-custodial ways and with configuration options and stuff. There's just a lot of complexity that all has to happen kind of at once. So I'm not suggesting it can't happen in the future. I'm just saying, like, why do we not have it? Because like a lot of these technologies weren't even invented 20 years ago, let alone right now, they're just kind of nascent. So like you could imagine a future, all the pieces that we kind of have together that a bunch of us kind of fringe people are playing with could become mainstream over time.
But like, I can call them fringe people.
So I want to go back on, David, you said that publishers have been accustomed to their ad-based model. And, you know, so it takes time to switch. I mean, that seemed true up until maybe 8 to 10 years ago, because that's when all of a sudden publishers added the paywall and were much more aggressive at getting consumers to subscribe. Mm-hmm. So I am a little surprised that in the past 10 years that's not been sufficient time to overcome building out that ecosystem that you just mentioned, which I agree it has to be built out. Definitely takes time. A little surprised it hasn't occurred the last 10 years, though.
In some sense, like, it kind of does happen. Like, look at YouTube. When YouTube started, there were zero videos on YouTube, right? And then it started and people started putting cat videos and like low value things and things that, you know, dog got a skateboard, stuff that people said there's no economic value in that. Well, as an internet native person, I would agree. But I think most people would say like, dog, I've got a funny video of a dog on a skateboard. Doesn't matter. There's no economic value here. Have it. Right. And I think that's the kind of stuff, like, you build out an ecosystem of that. That's the same website that today aggregates all kinds of premium TV channels and people pay $80 a month. It's the new cable bundle. And I think the way you get there is you start with people not, you know, kind of uneconomic content that people don't see as economic valuable, but that creates like networks and behaviors and gets people opted in. And then people start creating videos on there and they start getting paid ad rev share. So they don't get direct pay from the users, but again, the creator is getting paid ad rev share from YouTube. So I think there's just like a bit of an evolution. We saw it happen in video because video is so expensive both to maintain and it's just like was hard to serve. But I think we haven't had that same kind of pain. And I think the centralized coordinator there actually made it work in a way that we haven't seen outside yet.
Yeah.
But I'm optimistic that we can get there outside. I think we just need a little bit of like a galvanizing force to like demonstrate the whole kind of full stack end-to-end thing.
I mean, this is why I'm so excited about having an open payment protocol system and an open monetary system at the moment when agentic AI is exploding. Because I honestly think a big part of this answer is just inertia is tough and to undo. And there are only like certain periods in the history of whatever technology, the universe, where you can actually shift that inertia. And that's when something rapidly, rapidly changes. And so I actually think that I was chatting a bit with Jordy from FewSats about this. And Jordy made an interesting point to me, which is that Stripe arose and solved a problem of basically making it easy for anyone to accept money on the web. Because if you think about it, like, you know, there are new business models that are not just ads. If I'm a Stripe merchant or, you know, I can do subscriptions via Stripe, then that's a new way for me to monetize. And they kind of did all of the hard work of, I guess, aggregating all of the payment providers to make it easy to take money. But he made a very good point, which is, and kind of what FewSats is going after, which is now there's an opportunity to aggregate, making it easy to pay money on the web as well. And I think his argument, you know, I don't want to speak for him. I wouldn't say I understand entirely, but we have this monumental shift happening where, you know, everyone knows people are using Google less. There's like a lot fewer eyeballs on the long tail of the web. This is that whole Sutetri article I sent you guys. And so no one knows what the business model for the agentic web is going to be. But whether it's me as an individual or the agent acting on my behalf, somehow me or the agent is going out there scouring everything on, you know, the internet to get information and bringing me back some kind of answer. And it does seem like, you know, if everyone now, like we have the pieces coming, we have this open monetary system, we have the MCP sort of protocol, which allows anyone to hook up an MCP to their existing web or media or, you know, whatever agentic business they create. And now it does seem like there's this like really beautiful window of time for someone to come in, maybe to build the next Stripe, maybe it's Fusats or whatever it is, and say, okay, or maybe it's Albi with the wallet they already have. We're going to find a way to test this new business model. Cause like you still have to figure out if I'm willing to pay that money, how does the guy running the MCP server, how does he make money or more money than he would have made in the AdSense world? And I think that's like a giant open question, but like this seems like the time to be doing it.
Well, I mean, when I think about new internet businesses, especially things that touch consumers, I think one of the biggest questions I would want to answer is who is underpowered that this technology newly empowers? Like, and so get rid of all the other abstractions about like how great it would be if this worked and was at scale and blah, blah, blah. And just like, who's underpowered today and how do you make them superpowered? Like, how do they feel like they're superheroes now? And Stripe did that initially. Stripe, I think today Stripe worked with Apple and Amazon and stuff, Uber, but back in the day they didn't. They worked, you should actually look at their initial website. One of the archive.org, you can see like all their partners using Stripe and they're all these like ragtag, random jank projects. They're weekend projects. They're hack projects. And that's not like a bad thing. That's like when something is newly emergent, it's the people who are most desperate who are first to adopt it. And they're the biggest proponents and the fans of it and the promoters of it. And they actually create enough, like, in a sense, liquidity and value and like momentum that you can then kind of keep up leveling and up the ladder. So you continue to serve them and more of them, but then you go find the, you know, the Amazons and the Ubers of the world too. And actually some of those grow up, like Uber was much smaller when I think Stripe started serving them. And then their growth became Stripe's growth. So I would think about like in Fusat's case, like who's really underpowered today? Who's like, oh, I don't have a merchant account. If only I, you know, could hack a website together and have to deal with merchant services stuff, then I would build this website. But instead, I'm going to go spend the weekend, you know, hiking because like there's no merchant services thing. I don't want to solve that problem, right? I just want to build my website idea.
Well, one answer to that question is, and I don't know if this is, there's probably like a new explosive growth category I haven't thought of, but one answer is anyone that monetizes via the long tail of AdSense, they're probably losing their revenue right now. So if I've historically made some money offering my blog or whatever with AdSense, like I think there's no question the number of eyeballs using Google is going down with AI. Like more people are using ChatGPT and other Grok, whatever. And so one question is people that basically want to monetize MCP servers, that seems one group. But I don't know if that's like the explosive growth. What do you guys think? What do you think is the completely underserved category?
Well, that's probably a
trillion-dollar
question.
Yeah,
well,
that's what I'm asking.
well, I mean, I'll tell you about the project that I just started a couple days ago. I think I told Steve, but haven't told Max.
This is about dogs on the skateboard converting to humans.
It doesn't involve that, and it's actually changed since I started it. But it's a concept of like, you know, it's expensive to make VO3 videos, but they're very, very cool. Mm-hmm. And so could you create like a competition so that if you make a great VO3 video, you get submitted, voted on, judged, and you can actually win a prize like in Bitcoin? And so is there a way to take like the arbitrage between people's desire to create VO3, the cost to create it, and create some sort of economic opportunity for having created such a thing? Yeah. Right? So that's like a concept. I'm not saying that's the winning formula, but I feel like something where you try to make all the pieces hang together in a new set of incentives is, I think, kind of critical to kind of solving this problem or bootstrapping it in some way.
What do you think, Steve?
Not sure about underserved. I agree that's a good area to explore. I did have some, I mean, the Bitcoin versus stablecoins, I do wonder if there's an opportunity with Bitcoin around it just being ubiquitous. Whereas with stablecoins, there's not just one stablecoin. There's many issuers and there's many platforms. And it's a combinatorial explosion of pairs. And they aren't natively compatible with each other. So you need like swap providers and these intermediaries which extract fees. There's just economic friction between stablecoins. I think we maybe talked, I forget if we talked live in the show or just off the show, but about you know, is there going to emerge a dominant stablecoin? I mean, right now Tether is number one, and does Tether take over everything?
With Tron.
USDT on Tron, yeah.
But yeah, that's it. Tron, baby.
I don't.
Tron the standard.
I definitely don't foresee a world where there is a single pair that is dominant and stays dominant. Like, even in a world where Tether owns 99% of the market share, even that, they will probably evolve their underlying platform over time, which just creates all this incompatibility throughout wallets and the financial ecosystem. And I also don't think USDC is just going to roll over. Thank you. And there's other emerging ones too. So I think there'll be fierce competition. And for the next 5 to 10 years, at least, there'll be many, many pairs. And but with Bitcoin, there's just one Bitcoin. And that's why it's incredibly important.
Yes.
Right now within Bitcoin, Lightning Network and the Lightning Payment Protocol is like the common language between all wallets, whether you're using Spark, Arc, Custodial, Lightning, Cashew, whatever. That doesn't exist on Solana or Ethereum or basically the stablecoin world. So, even within Bitcoin, there's always new competing payment protocols which stand to add friction. And I think that's dangerous. So Bitcoin has a lead there. Let's make sure it keeps that lead in terms of interoperability and compatibility and reducing economic friction and UX friction. And then that could be a big differentiator between stablecoins and Bitcoin. So if you're an AI or you're a merchant or a service or whatever, and you just want to accept money, it's just way easier to get started with Bitcoin. And actually, evolving that idea. So let's say you're a startup. Maybe you eventually, when you're really successful, you accept many different forms of money. But where do you start? And if you're a startup, why not start with Bitcoin? And today, is it widely accepted? And are there a lot of spending wallets? No. But there's no doubt in my mind there's going to soon be, tens, hundreds of millions of people around the world in their mobile wallet and agents who can spend Bitcoin. They'll have spending wallets for Bitcoin. And then why it'll become the obvious first choice to accept money will be Bitcoin.
So I think there's a couple ways this could play out. And I think this is the most important question, not only for startups and businesses, but also for whether our future is authoritarian or not, whether we have freedom in the future or not. So I think one interesting question, and I actually don't know all the numbers on this, I would want to go look at a bunch of these different venues, is so clearly Bitcoin has a network effect around people holding Bitcoin, store value, all that. There's no question. It has somewhat of a network effect around payments at sites like Bitrefill and, in the old days with things like Local Bitcoins and my understanding, like Paxful, whatever those companies are in emerging markets. However, stablecoins clearly also have a real network effect in emerging markets in places like, various African countries, Argentina, Vietnam, for actual on the ground real payments. And so there's no question that stablecoins are kind of in my mind, at least winning for the normie user doing payments today. Now, that doesn't mean Bitcoin can't win, because we already have this huge sort of distribution of people that are holding it. So the question in my mind is, there's a few ways this could go. One way is, if something like Tether on Tron got absolute dominant market share, I could see where it becomes the payment standard. I don't think that's going to happen either, because there's going to be so much competition for people trying to issue their own stable coins. Then the question is there a way to make all of those other stable coins and networks interoperable? This is what a company like Bridge is trying to do, right? Which is literally an exchange between stable coins. And that's why they got acquired by Stripe for billions of dollars. So Stripe is kind of making the bet that, does it matter if there's a long tail of stable coins as long as we can be the one to market make between them? So that's one option. The thing that makes me a little nervous there is it doesn't seem like Stripe or any of those guys or Bridge are leaning into also doing the interoperable market making with Bitcoin, right? Those are all they're regulated, stable coins on platforms like Ethereum or Polygon or Solana and certainly Tron. And so Then the question becomes, another way that this could go is stablecoins do get very popular, but because Bitcoin is so widely distributed and people want to get in and out of their savings vehicle, that you have stablecoins that also speak Bitcoin Lightning. This is the Taproot asset bet from Lightning Labs. This is the Spark bet from Lightspark. I think it's the Cashew and eCash bet from guys that are speaking Lightning. I think it's extremely important in that world if you want Bitcoin to not just become an ETF sort of savings vehicle. Somehow, I don't know what the answer is, but you need to build that interoperability between stablecoins and the Bitcoin Lightning networks right now. This is the moment that needs to happen, I think. The most likely,
is there anybody doing stuff like that? Like, is it relatively easy to swap between USDT on Tron and Bitcoin?
No.
And is that, like, are there technical limitations that prevent that? Or
I think there are
business model that drives
doesn't Speed Wallet or Speed do that?
Well, Speed is one example, but they're, like, relatively small compared to, like, whatever the dominant Tron wallet is in Argentina. My understanding is, if you want to get, let's say, like, where there's actual distribution, there's possibility, and Speed is showing that it's possible. But if you really want to get between Tether and Bitcoin in, you know, Mexico, let's say, you're using Bitso. So the way to do it is through a centralized exchange, which is fine, but that's obviously a bit of a choke point as well. I still think, and I've said this for many years, I funded a startup, sadly, you know, it probably wasn't the right one, but I still think this is a huge, years ago, still think this is a huge opportunity now, which is to build a bridge between Bitcoin and all of the stablecoin stuff using the Lightning Network. Maybe Bridge will be the one to do it. I doubt it. I think that's just like, if I were like looking for what is the huge, huge like Coinbase, next Coinbase size opportunity, I think it's for people to market make between Bitcoin and all the stablecoins. The Taproot asset Lightning Labs vision of that is that that's all going to happen on edge nodes within their ecosystem. Maybe that works. I'm sure Lightspark has their own version of that as well. But I think there's tremendous opportunity there. The other thing is, just from a sort of like freedom perspective, you know, if it all comes, the exchange, like, basically it comes into these choke points, like, you know, and I'm a big fan of Bitso, but like if it becomes just a few centralized exchanges, then I think that's kind of like, if you put your conspiracy hat on, kind of like the path of like just turn Bitcoin into this like capital asset, which is sitting in ETFs, and like try and choke off the points to make it be used as money. My guess is, if Bitcoin is going to become money, we've talked about this many times. I've mentioned my pod with Drew Bansal on Ideas from the Edge, where we talked a lot about this. It's probably going to happen in gray markets first, is still my guess. So whether that's incentivizing torrents or, you know, some whatever providers that for whatever reason have trouble plugging into the traditional payment rails, that's probably, just like Bitcoin got its first start with Silk Road and sort of adoption of the dark web, it's probably the most likely trajectory. Obviously, I'm not saying anyone should do whatever illegal things, but if I had to guess, it's probably going to follow that kind of a pattern.
Now, on this swap idea that you touched on, isn't my understanding is that part of the core technology innovation or kind of breakthrough that Shazan and the team at Lava worked on was being able to bridge the understanding of something that happened on a USDT on Sol with something that's happening on the Bitcoin blockchain, that the kind of how you look at how the two of those things understand each other is a big part of what makes Lava work, even, you know, even possible to do. Is that true? And if it is, if that's
have they published anything?
I never
understand any details about Lava's stablecoins.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that is published. My guess is it's something that, well, my understanding is that's pretty core to how it works, and it seems reasonable. I know we had a little discussion with Shazan the other day around, like, can I pay in elephants or something? You were talking about trying to resolve.
It just, for me, it seems super opaque. So,
yeah, I mean,
I don't think we have the information to even learn about it.
Yeah, I think Shazan, if you or the Lava team are listening to this, I know in other conversation, we've talked a little bit about this bridge idea. I think it'd be super cool to publish like an essay or one, like to Steve's point, explain how the DLC Oracle in Bitcoin land speaks with the Solana USDC. I think that's what they're using. So that would be interesting, one thing to learn. But two, I think this maybe even expanding this like vision of what it could look like to have, because to take a step back, for those of you who are not familiar, so Lightning Network, you know, uses hashed.
Oops, we might have. Max, I think maybe your mic died. Do you need to charge it up?
The battery didn't last very long.
Yeah, I think it was only partially charged.
I guess maybe it has a two-hour battery life.
Yeah.
Okay.
But my understanding is if Lava did achieve that, and I think you're right, there probably should be more publishing on exactly how that works. But wouldn't that, as a component, be useful to just like make available to other wallets that wanted to make that kind of interoperability easy? Like anybody who today supports USDT in any form, Sol or Tron or whatever, probably could benefit from being able to have that wallet sort of just be able to swap yeah. that, right?
But definitely, I mean,
we're back. Okay, cool.
We're back. Awesome. So David just asked, if we assume that Lava works that way, wouldn't that be useful? But I'd say that we know a lot more about Spark and Taproot assets, and that's absolutely part of each of their ecosystems' vision is to be bridge compatibility between Bitcoin and stablecoins.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah. So they seem to have way more development, and I mean, it's more of a thrust of those two ecosystems than Lava, and there's more information about them. I think there's no, and then there's, you know, bridge.xyz, which StripeBot, I mean, these already exist in its early days. We can assume it'll be there, but it's still economic friction. I mean, it's both economic friction and regulatory choke points too. All these swap providers, it's hard to imagine them existing without regulatory oversight and without KYC. So there's UX friction there, and there's economic friction. They also seem like they'll have strong centralization tendencies, which just to me means a recreation of Visa, and like the fees might start free, and then they get more expensive, and then more expensive, and then we just sort of wind up with what we have today.
Yeah, I agree.
So that would be a concern.
I think the only way to get around that, though, is like the beauty of the Lightning Network is it can operate with any crypto chain that uses hash time lock contracts or HTLCs. Now, there's some issues around that with like you can, you know, potentially have this free option problem of like how long you're waiting for something to settle between those, I guess, two chains. But I'm trying to find right now Casey Rodemore of Ordinal Infamy. He published a blog. Casey, by the way, for those of you who don't know, I know he's a controversial figure within the Bitcoin ecosystem, but that guy is so fucking smart and has so much alpha. He published sort of an article or blog like 5 years ago talking about like decentralized Lightning Network bridge swaps between Bitcoin and like all these other chains. I still think, so if someone's...
We lost you again, Max.
Max, I think we lost you. I don't know if you were swapping out to your swaps. I don't know if you're swapping out to your other wireless mic, or if you just want to go raw. And
maybe he needs to bridge.
Yeah, maybe he needs to bridge his swap a little better. All right. Well, I didn't like him anyway.
But another thing we should talk about is I believe Lightning is unique in the world right now in providing instant settlement, where instant is like 1 second. So another way to like analyze this opportunity or challenge is what use cases demand finality in 1 second. Were you able to hear what I just said, Max?
I think I got the gist.
Yeah. So this actually gets back to, you mentioned Gigi's article, and where he states that the reason micropayments haven't taken off is because they're incompatible with like a credit system. Whether we believe that or not, to whatever degree it's true, Lightning is transformational, and that it's not a credit system. You get finality of your payment within 1 second. So what are use cases and product opportunities that require that type of instant settlement that are incompatible with any kind of credit system? Like they need the trust of the finality of the payment. And whatever those are, Bitcoin and Lightning should be a very natural fit for.
I think the most likely one of those is a combination of two things we've discussed, which is agentic stuff, AI. And so for those who, you know, I think this is actually a really important point worth hitting on. In the old model of the internet or the web, you effectively had zero marginal cost every time you like called a server. It was some cost, but it's like, it's effectively zero. In the agentic version of the web, every time you ask a model to do anything or perform any kind of inference, there is a real world cost. So that's a really, really important primitive to understand, because if there's a real world cost, someone has to pay that cost. And if I am using a credit system, and let's say, you know, every time I call an inference, it's a penny, and I call, you know, 10 million inferences on you, or 100 million inferences on you, and then all of a sudden you're left with $1 million bill if I default, that's a real cost that businesses cannot sustain. So that's one thing to understand. Now, in a lot of the world, if you're working with Google and other trusted providers, they'll be able to sustain that cost, likely based on trust. So I think it's going to be some combination of AI, again, the kind of long tail or gray market or gray web version of all of this, where if, let's say, for whatever reason, I don't want to use all of the like centralized trusted models like Google or OpenAI, maybe because I don't trust their data, and I want to be able to use a free market of model providers who I trust to either store my data better, or for whatever reason, I think Lightning real-time settlement for something with a real-world cost, which is electricity and computational cost, that is using something like Nostr Web of Trust, or is not using the old world trust systems, that to me is where the explosion is going to happen. Now, the question is, what's going to be that first killer app where I'm using the free market of models for inference instead of the centralized providers? That I don't know.
And the centralized providers have a lot of ability to subsidize usage for a long time. So that's another headwind, like to really cut through all of the noise and make something work like this, I think you really need to, in a sense, control a lot of it and then be willing to let go of a lot over time. Sort of, you almost need to start centralized with ideology to control or to let go of control over time versus, you know, sort of let these things truly bottom up emerge. Great. But you need somebody who's like pushing it forward, who's going to make that happen, because you have centralized providers who are subsidizing and making it much cheaper to do that. And like rational actors are going to say, you know, like Google just launched this Gemini code thing, and you get like, you know, I think 1,000 prompts a day or something that's subsidized, right? Like it's paid for by the ad network. So like if you're building another, you know, another IDE or agentic coding service, you don't have the ability to subsidize like that. So in a sense, like people aren't always rational on the transaction level. They're actually rational over time, but that time can be brought forward by subsidy from other business models. So I really think you need like a very specific, strong reason to do something different.
Well, and that's why I come back to the, and I don't know what it is, but this sort of gray area, right? So like where I still think this is really going to pop, again, I'm not suggesting anyone do this, but I think this is just looking at reality as it is say there's some sort of like new gambling agent, and that agent is doing some kind of like, I don't know, like like scraping a bunch of MCP servers that are getting data for betting on sports or something, where in your jurisdiction, you can't use Google because the government just says you can't. And so your option is you either use this gray world or you don't. And that's probably where it's going to pop.
I'm in agreement. I mean, I said for a long time, gambling, gaming, adult, that's, those are kind of good use cases because they're
DK brings it back.
More desperate need is always going to be better.
Hey guys, we got about 15 minutes left. I think we wanted to cover the Fannie Mae topic.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. Should we switch to that?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Because I think the payment stuff, it's going to be a recurring theme on this show. So we'll definitely discuss that again. But I guess it's been, I think, 2 days ago. Bill Pulte, I saw a tweet by him. I didn't even know he was part of the U.S. administration until he tweeted that. But is it the housing department?
I think he's the head of the FHA, and he runs one of the largest home builders in the U.S.
Classic Trump. Classic Trump administration.
But he's also a Bitcoiner, so, you know.
I lived in a Bill Pulte home in Tucson, Arizona. That was a Pulte home.
Did it have his name up in neon right on the front door.
No.
Was it a great, big, beautiful home?
It was a nice, I mean, it's a track home, but it was a nice home. I didn't know he was part of the administration, but I definitely had seen several years ago that he's a Bitcoiner because he is like giving away Bitcoin on Twitter and stuff like that. And now he announced 2 days ago that he's ordered Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to treat cryptocurrency as an asset to be considered when someone applies for a mortgage. So that's a big announcement because I know historically, not only did most lenders not count Bitcoin or any kind of cryptocurrency as an asset, it could even be a negative for I have several friends who once a bank learned they owned Bitcoin, they got put in the naughty, risky folder. And it didn't even matter that they had ample assets, traditional assets like stocks, to cover the loan. They were discounted because they just owned Bitcoin. So it's obviously a major, announcement and major progress to flip that on its head. So overall, I think it's very good news. There are some cautions with it, though, in that it also came with the caveat that the cryptocurrency has to be with a regulated exchange. So, that creates a disincentive to self-custody. So if it turns out that people who are already self-custodying decide then to store their Bitcoin with Coinbase in order to take advantage of this, that is a net, or I don't know if it's a net negative. It is a drawback to this. And if there's people who are currently using a custodian, but would have otherwise self-custodied, but then no longer decide to because of this, that would also be a negative. Similar to like with ETFs. I mean, overall, I think it's a net positive for the space, especially when it creates opportunities for new people to enter Bitcoin and who otherwise would not have. But when you have people who previously self-custodied sell their Bitcoin to buy BlackRock ETF, that act, I think, is actually quite bad for Bitcoin. So then that created a conversation on social media about why, and we chatted privately as well about why self-custody was not included. A traditional Bitcoiner would put on their conspiracy hat and think that it's the government intentionally trying to get everyone to custody. Maybe, but we also came up with like legitimate reasons as well. And DK, you brought up reasons. Seasoning funds is one of them, and I'd never heard of that term before. So thanks for educating us. But I knew the concept. I just didn't know that was the term. But basically, it's very common for a lender, if they're going to look at assets you have like stocks, to judge your merit for a loan or the rate you're going to get or the terms or whatever, that stock that's held at that lender or their financial institution, it needs to have been held for like 60 days or 90 days or maybe 6 months or some period of time there, so that you're not like quickly moving them in and out between financial institutions and taking out more loans than in aggregate than any one institution is aware of. With self-custody, if it was, how would you demonstrate you own the Bitcoin? And what prevents you from, I think a scenario you brought up, David, was, like a group of friends could get together, pool their funds, make it look like any one of them has a lot more money than they have. And then we could just like go around the group and all of us look like we have five times more money than we actually have. But there are solutions to these problems. So, for one, you can prove your ownership of Bitcoin, even if it's in self-custody. And two, the protocol has time locks built into it. So you can lock up your funds for any period of time. So if Fannie Mae has a 90-day requirement, okay, there can be a solution. And there are solutions that exist where you can lock up your Bitcoin. Solutions meaning the protocol supports it, but there's also wallets that support locking up your Bitcoin for 90 days. And then you can prove that to the lender, and they can be confident that you're not you know, sharing it with friends, at least within that 90-day window, whatever the requirement is. So I think what I was left with is like, we need to understand what the requirements are. And no one, even like Alex from River, didn't even know what the requirements are. He doesn't even know if he's going to be able to participate in this, even though he has a regulated business. But, you know, there's different regulators and different licenses. And is he the right one? He doesn't know. Then there's providers like Unchained Capital. You know, are they part of this? Or so it'd be good to understand what the requirements are, both for businesses, but also just for self-custody and open source processes.
Yeah, but my guess, so thanks for the overview. And I mean, there's so many details to this. I've been researching it a lot and kind of learning new things and kind of making new estimates about it. But I think one of the things is, you know, and I'm certainly, you know, very willing to distrust any move by the government and willing to wear a tinfoil hat and stuff. But I don't think that this is as much of a like conspiracy by the government to get, you know, your Bitcoin into a third party exchange or something. I think it's more just like, it's the easiest way to parallel the existing system and have like information sharing networks where there's like US regulated entity that has to participate in the information sharing so that you can watch how money moves around and try to understand what risk there actually is. The 90 days seasoning of funds is one thing, but oftentimes there's also a question of like, where did these funds come from? And you have to like attest to the source of funds. And if every 90 days you moved that around, you could still play that little collusion game. If you're not buying new homes every 90 days, you know, I could gather up a bunch of funds, hold them for 90 days, time lock it if need be. And then once I'm approved for a mortgage, I could push the funds over to the other friend in the ring. And we could still create a ring of fraud that way, which we don't want to do. And we would hope that there's a solution where you could prevent that in a similar way to preventing preventing fraud or limiting fraud in the reducing risk in the current system. So I think time locks are potentially interesting, but that's a little bit closer to collateralizing. And I think the point here is that this is explicitly not collateral for a mortgage. This is asset determination, which helps the lender understand if you're likely to be a good risk and if you have funds available to, you know, reserve funds available to pay down your mortgage in case you lost your job or whatever.
I mean, I'll just make one comment on that because I actually think this is very interesting. I think that, I mean, there's the question of the time lock, which is cool, but I think to me, this is more of an opportunity to create protocols to basically create new forms of reputation and insurance. I think this is actually a very interesting opportunity for people in the Nostr ecosystem to start exploring. So one question is, can I say I have this amount of money? Can I just prove I have that money? Well, that's what proof of reserves and companies like Hoseki already have solutions built out for that, which is great, but it doesn't answer any of the questions of like potential, you know, collusion with other people or moving the funds around after that.
But how does it work with the prove that I have the money? It means something about like
you sign a message with, I guess, the UTXO that controls a certain amount of Bitcoin that proves, you know, the holder of this private key signed this message. So they have the private key.
Yeah, but the issue is if you're talking about like a mortgage, you're back in TradFi and now you're back in KYC land. And so how do you tie that signed message
to KYC? This is where I'm going with this. So I think then the more interesting question is, that's like step zero. The more interesting question is building a protocol where you can demonstrate, for example, if I were going to sign a message for this, there's a couple of different ways I could do this. One is I want to say, not only do I have control of this UTXO, but two, I'm committing this UTXO to a very specific loan. So there's a message basically that says like, hey, here's the loan that I'm, you know, taking out. This UTXO is tied to this for some specified amount of time, whether it's time locked or not. Then you may have a separate piece. And again, if you do this more modular, you can plug and play depending on who you're working with, which is kind of like a KYC module. And so I know, you know, this is kind of like some of the vision for what TBD was working on with verifiable credentials and all of the Web5 stuff. I think this can get rebuilt in Nostr is my guess of where it's going to happen. But you could literally have, you know, a third party that says, so imagine you have the person who holds UTXO, you have the lender, then you also have a KYC provider. And maybe the lender has a list of KYC providers that they're willing to work work with. So then you, as the UTXO holder, go and work with whoever the KYC provider is. They say, yep, we know this key, you know, whatever, out of band, this person, whatever, is who they say they are. And then the lender can choose who they're willing to accept a verifiable credentials from. So someone then attests on top of that loan. So as the UTXO holder, I say, I'm associating my UTXO with this loan. On top of that, this third party has come in and given me some whatever credibility and signed a message saying, yes, we know this is Max or whoever they say they are. But someone has to put all those pieces together.
I think that solves the problem that you put forth, David.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like those feel to me like the right kinds of building blocks. My guess is the current system is not as exacting as one might imagine. Like there's a lot of wiggle room in how it actually works, but it's like good enough and people understand it. And then all these ingredients could be built out into a totally new system that's actually much easier to verify and more open and actually more rigorous about how it works. But it does take somebody kind of pushing that agenda and putting those pieces together and then kind of building the product on top of that and delivering that to the market.
Looping back to our earlier conversation, my guess is, again, you look where the tectonic plates are shifting. Maybe the place to really get this thing going, because again, like whenever you have to fight the inertia of the old world, it's tough. And unless it's at least 10x better or 100x better, it's just, and even then with Bitcoin, right, it's still a multi-decade process. Maybe someone's going to pilot this in a brand new area, like loans for agents. So you have autonomous agents that are out there and you're like, okay, this agent wants a loan. Okay. That means all of the old world system is just thrown out of the window. Who's going to build a financial system for agents? And that all has to do with like native public private keys from the ground up. There is no like concept of a human. That to me is like an interesting area that I would be exploring.
Yeah. Touching on the point I was sharing before is I think you know, a lot of times in consumer internet stuff, you want to find people who are severely underpowered because they become the big champions. And it strikes me that with this kind of idea, there's a bunch of people who probably have some amount of Bitcoin wealth who have very little TradFi wealth, and they would be the people who would be underpowered candidates, that they like really want this. And if you can provide them even a fairly broken solution, they will gobble it up and use it and sort of promote it and ask for more, because you know, they're sort of like so disempowered in the current system, and this would become like the first step of empowerment. But I know, Steve, you've been a little active on Twitter, kind of asking like, where have the open source developers been and why are we not part of this conversation? Have you heard anything back about, you know, from Pulte or any of the other participants in this?
Still don't know the requirements. So I think that would be good to have publish. I got reminded of, the startup, I think it's pronounced Hoseki app, as Sam from he used to work for Fidelity, started that several years ago. They do proof of UTXO ownership, including for self-custody. So that seems like a piece of the puzzle. I mean, many open source Bitcoin advocates liked my tweet, but yeah. No one's signed up yet to work on this. Although, you know, I guess maybe it's less of a open source project and more like a product that needs to be built that takes a bunch of existing open source software and bundles it together into a compelling package for consumers.
Yeah, and also I guess part of that, it might be a new startup opportunity, but part of that would be whoever's driving that initiative should be in the conversation as we're figuring out how the U.S. exchanges that get the regulated U.S. exchanges participate in whatever information sharing network there is. Does that person have a seat at the table?
You know, kind of another natural. I didn't mention Casa, but like Nick Newman too would be a natural person. Like he should have a seat at the table. You know, Casa, Unchained, River, all those companies. I don't think they understand yet, and clearly they should be in the loop on this. So it'd be good if the government like published the requirements and include folks like that at the seat of the table.
Do we know which U.S. exchanges are approved? I assume Coinbase is one.
Coinbase.
Is that the only one? Or because I would have guessed River would be another candidate.
Did they announce Coinbase was approved?
No.
No, I think it's just an assumption. We don't know. I don't think anyone knows yet. A product idea, perhaps this summer for me to play with vibe coding, I could see something like BTC seasoning. .xyz or season.xyz, maybe BTC paprika .xyz. And I do think there's a really interesting opportunity to build for this long tail, whether it's agent loans or the kind of like marginal, the people on the edges that got rich off Bitcoin early on. Like that to me is extremely promising for someone to build this like parallel system. And maybe it's less, I agree the Rivers of the world should be the ones really hammering home on this like work with the traditional mortgage lenders. But I think there's going to be huge opportunity for a sort of parallel financial system, parallel lending system for agents, the sort of marginal people, let's say. And that's like an area I would definitely be sniffing in. And so maybe we'll help some of those guys get seasoned.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that I would say is best about this announcement, I can't tell yet how much real impact this has, given that it's FHA loans and it's not using it as collateral, but it's using it as asset evaluation. So it's like a very kind of, in a sense, it applies to a lot of people, but it wouldn't surprise me if there's like a very narrow set of people who actually get value from, like, they have an FHA or need an FHA loan and they need to demonstrate additional reserves beyond what their income shows. Like it may be a bit of a niche, I don't know. But I think it does drive the narrative forward that like Bitcoin is relevant as an asset to consider for any kind of loan, you know, mortgages, but also any other kind of loan. It starts to kind of give it some more credibility. So I do think like the more that this narrative emerges, the better it is for Bitcoin in all kinds of contexts. Even if this one, I don't know how much it's used.
I agree too. Is the argument then, just to be clear, because I didn't realize that, I thought you could use it as collateral. Like, so that actually seems a lot less powerful. If you can't use it as collateral, is the like the benefit besides maybe getting approved when you wouldn't have gotten approved that you might get a better interest rate?
Yeah. I think you could get approval where you wouldn't have gotten approved, you get a better interest rate. But basically you're showing the lender like, hey, I have such and such, like say W-2 income that should qualify me for a certain value of a home. And they say, well, do you have 12 months of reserve in case you lose your job? Then you can still pay your mortgage. And so you can show that reserve in US dollars and stocks, or now you could show it in Bitcoin. As long as it's held in, you know.
Or fart coin maybe,
yeah.
He said cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
Not Bitcoin. So
yeah, I saw a Nostra post from Alex Gladstein this morning that I thought was just right on the money. It's like, because he was talking about how he was in DC. It is, again, not to harp on this point, we have to move forward, but it's just like crypto has done so much damage. It's so frustrating. Like why is Bitcoin still being lumped in with Fartcoin? Or even Ethereum?
Someone at the event last night said that, jokingly, that they are going to create a new coin and then sell one of those tokens to their friend for a dollar, and all of a sudden they're worth $10 million, and then use that for their Fannie Mae loan.
Yeah.
But I think there has to be some kind of liquidity requirement, among other things. Ultimately, just Bitcoin. But
yeah, exactly.
Anyway,
it is what it is. Yeah, let's wrap.
Should we wrap? We're a little over?
Yeah.
I think we're good.
Cool. All right. Well, good to see you guys. See you guys in person soon.
Hey, now are we doing something different next week? Because of
So I think we're not doing it on the 4th of July because it's the 4th of July. And we did share enthusiasm for not missing next week, though. So we need to come to an agreement. Are we going to do it on Wednesday or Thursday? Or I think we're pretty flexible. So anyone who's planning to tune in next Friday, just a heads up that we'll probably do Wednesday or Thursday instead.
Yeah, but look for it on Wednesday or Thursday because we're doing it.
Stay tuned.
Okay.
All right. Bye, everyone.
See ya.
Goodbye.